Okay, so joining me on the podcast today is none other than Jimmy Crouch. Now, Jimmy, the reason why I got you on was because just recently you sent me a video to a little documentary that you did for your stand-up. And I just could not believe in the short time that I've known you for only a couple of years, how far you've come in terms of comedy and how well you've stuck to your guns, man. Now, that's something I just got to say right off the bat. Because when I met you, I remember it pretty well. It was in September of 2019 in the Bastardine Hotel for Flying Camel Comedy.
How do you remember what month?
Well, the reason why is because it was only a couple of weeks after my birthday. And that's when I said,
I thought it was because you went, wow, I just met the only man on the planet who's sexier than me. This is something I should write down because it's a small miracle.
Well, it was a good time for me because that was the week before I did my first ever stand-up comedy gig. And one thing that I respect so much about you is just like how friendly you were, and especially in the comedy scene where, you know, everyone's got their insecurities, but for you to be like so open, that's what I gotta respect, man. So thanks for coming on.
Did you in comedy, people are insecure, broken people? I personally never noticed that, Joe. It's interesting that you point that out.
Yeah, well, it's just I don't know. I've been in a few places, quite a few places. I'm not going to point any names, but whenever we did the Bastardine Hotel, everyone was always like, "Hey man, how you going? What's up?" But sometimes I go to other places, everyone was just mute. Just
yes, you are correct. Mute at best, you know. Luckily, mute is better than if they express themselves because they tend to not be kind and loving all the time. But what we tried to do, as you noticed, is, and I did it pretty purposefully, right? Like with a purpose, you know, driving what I was doing. And that was, we divided the scene in half and essentially put a wedge down the center of it, where I stood in the center, and the people who were negative, I just made them stay away. And then anybody who wanted to be positive and work together and have fun and just be kind and normal and, you know, the functional people, we just all started working together. And so, and look, in the short term, of course, it was mostly people who were new and didn't know how to do comedy. And so our side of the scene was, comically speaking, weak, but a hell of a lot more fun and just, you know, a good time to be around. And it actually made you grow as a person and this kind of thing. And now over the last maybe 2.5 years, those people who were new are starting to get pretty damn good, you know, and they still have that positive attitude and they want to achieve their goals and they're not out to cut the legs out from under you and stuff. So I'm really enjoying where the scene is currently.
That's actually one of the things I wanted to bring up right now. Well done, by the way, on your gig in the Astro Theater. Now you've been doing stand-up comedy for how many years now?
Well, in April it's 6 years.
April 6 years, very nice. And you, before this, you worked as a chiropractor. What was it like?
I still do.
And you still do?
Because in Perth, if you want to be a professional comedian, there's no foundation for that. There's like one professional club. Mm-hmm. So even if he says, hey, you're the best in Perth, I'm going to put you on as much as possible. The most he could put you on is maybe 10 times a year at $400 each, like, you know, or maybe it's 20, right? So you might get $8,000 worth of work out of that professional comedy club. But, you know, over in Melbourne, they've got 10 or 12 or something like that of them. So there you could make a living out of comedy, or in the States or in the UK. But here in Perth, you've got to run all of your own gigs. And until you can start to do bigger things, you know, book out theaters, run your own tours, do online stuff. But here in Perth, it's very difficult to be a proper professional full-time comedian.
Why do you, and so last time I saw you, you told me that you and Tim and Gareth and Jasky are going on the road. Like, what was it that what motivated you to go on the road?
Well, again, it had to do with the, there's a low ceiling in Perth. You can only reach so high in comedy. So you need to start to travel around WA to see, you know, how do you go around the entire state? And then go national, you know, go over to Adelaide, Melbourne, the small towns in country Victoria, because you also need to see not just, okay, so I know that in Western Australia, in Perth, and also we've tested Western Australia to a degree, I know my material works, but is my material well received in America or in the UK? That's really important because those are bigger markets. So at some point, we've got to start to travel. And we were going to start to do a national tour, of course, this year, you know, but everything is still haywire with COVID. So I'm doing a lot more where I'm spending a lot of time editing videos and stuff like this with my comedy videos and other videos. And then we are going to do another tour around WA. And this time what we'll do is Tim, who was my MC, and he's my business partner in comedy, this year will be all about him. He'll be our headliner. I'll be the MC. Gareth will still be in the middle. And then in the next year, we're going to start to build Gareth into being able to headline so that all three of us can headline, all three of us can MC, and all three of us can be the support act. And that way it can change every time. And instead of having to do an hour and a half of material on stage, we can each do a half hour. And it's always a little bit different. Like if you've got 2 hours worth of material, but you only have to do a half hour, then every time it's a little bit different. So audiences come back and they go, man, it's different every time. And it's still hilarious.
Wow. So you came over from the United States with your wife. And so, yeah. So what was that like for you? Like moving over from America to Australia?
To be honest, we didn't come straight from America, so it was not that different. We first moved to Croatia, and that is a totally different world, like a totally different way of thinking and stuff like this. Like, we had to go and have some business papers signed one time, so we've gone to the courts, and we show up, and it's around like 11 in the morning on a Wednesday, and there's nobody there. And there's one guy who's like a bailiff. I said, where's the judge? He looked at me like I was crazy. He says, what do you mean? It's a beautiful day. She is at the beach. I was like, holy shit, right? And so Croatia was a totally different world. Then we moved to Germany, which was like America with people who just speak a different language. And it was like Germany was a cross between kind of Croatia and England. And so the next place we moved was England. And then after that, we came to Australia. And Australia is very much a cross between England and America, as you probably know. So we were like, wow, Australia is the closest thing you can get to America without having the problem of having all of the Americans. So it's just heaven.
Fair enough, very nice. So when you took your, you're still doing your chiropractic business, what was it down the line? Now I know you mentioned this in your video, but just for the viewers, like, what was it down the line in your line of work that made you think, okay, I want to start getting into comedy?
It was very random. It didn't happen. So I never wanted to do comedy. It was nothing I ever thought about. In fact, because my old man was just hilarious, we'd walk by street performers and he'd just look at them and under his breath, he would say to me, get a real fucking job. Right? So I never looked at comedy or any of that kind of stuff as like a real job. I mean, I don't know, that's terrible, but it wasn't until I was 38 and I was just looking for a change in my life and going, you know, I want to try something that I've never done before. Because as I was saying to my missus, look, our life is perfect. Everything is running great. There's no need to change anything. But if what happens is, I've heard this professional speaker and he talked about when you're comfortable in life, it makes you weak because you're no longer growing. And I went, holy shit, I'm no longer growing. I need something to do. And I was thinking, oh, what can I do? Change of pace sometimes. And maybe it was a midlife crisis or something, but I just kind of went, I want to do something that I've never done for a challenge. And then one day after a couple of months of this, one day it just popped in there. And I was like, no, ain't going to happen. Not going to do that. And then about a week later, it popped in there again. And I went, you know what? Screw it. Like, I'm not going to be on my deathbed going, I had this idea once 40 years ago, and I never did it. Because to me, the worst thing I could die with is having regrets. I'd rather get into comedy and fail miserably, you know, put all my eggs in one basket, put all my effort into it, and fail miserably, than look back on my life and go, you weren't even willing to fail. So that's why I went, screw it, I'm going to do it.
Okay. And so what was your first gig like?
My first gig was incredible because I didn't know what I was doing. Right? I didn't even have jokes written. I think I had some ideas prepared, and the lady called me like about 3 weeks ahead of when I was supposed to have a spot, and she said, look, we have an opening. Do you want to go on tomorrow? I kind of got that wrong in the video. They didn't edit it right, but it was like I was booked for like 3 weeks and, you know, out, and then she called me the day before and said, do you want to go on? And I went, yeah, I'll do it, right? And so I got up there, and I just told, you know, five stories, and dude, the crowd was going wild, and all the comedians were like, that was unbelievable. So then right away, I'm like, oh, my God, I might be the Jesus Christ of comedy. So then my next gig came, and it was just onstage abortion. Like, you couldn't look, but you couldn't look away. It was just cringeworthy. It was horrific. So my gig number 2 through about 17 were just terrible. And then after that, it got better.
Yeah, very nice. So knowing you and watching you perform, one thing we talk about openly is that you're a big fan of dark material. Personally, I do show that, share that same view, because I mean, I believe that the best thing about comedy is that it's about pushing the pen, you know, it's about pushing it to the limit. And then you can, because I believe that you should be able, you should be able to joke about anything. I don't think there should be really any topics as long as you know, if it's like well thought out, and then you look at what the context is and what the intent is. Now, as someone who shares that, sorry, go on, you were going to say something?
Well, there's a couple of things there. It's great to have good intent, okay? But you're always going to have people interpret it through their eyes. Right? Which means it doesn't matter what your intent is, then somebody's going to get pissed off. So you're always going to lose, even if it's well written. 5% of the audience is going to find a reason to complain. I do a joke where I say, you can't say the R word anymore. You can't say retard anymore. Now you have to call them by the proper term, which is feminist. And the audience cracks up, right? I have one kid, so I have this video online. I had a woman complain about it. Now, clearly, why would she be complaining? Because she's a feminist, right? No, she actually complained saying that I find this very offensive because I have a son with Down syndrome. And I answered the comment. I went, no, the joke's not about that. It's, I say in the joke, you can't say that. Like, this is clearly a joke about feminism. And she said, well, I find it very offensive and you shouldn't do it anymore. And I just put on the comments, okay, I agree. And then she left it be. I don't know. Like, something that's a weird hang-up. So when you do dark material, I mean, there's a couple of types of dark material. There's the one where you're pushing the envelope. You're seeing, you know, what can we talk about? I think mine is more pushing buttons. See if I can upset people and then find where that line is where they're like, oh, I should be upset about this, but I'm not because I'm a logical person. But then you'll lose that 5%. Who will groan a little bit, or they'll just be grumpy. And you just have to accept that you've lost them, because with your kind of cookie cutter, kind of like white appliance comedy, where it's all about, let me tell you about my dishwasher, like that kind of thing, you'll get a laugh. And 80% or 100% of the audience will be like, okay with it. They'll be like, yeah, it's funny, but you won't be memorable. And I think to be memorable, you need to be upsetting so that even if they hate you, they remember you. But then, of course, you want to have your joke worded properly so that 95% of the audience not only remembers you, but they go, man, he was funny and I enjoyed it and I was on board. And then that other 5%, you just got to go, whatever. It doesn't really matter. Like, they can hate me and they can spread the word about how much they hate me. And then most of the people that they tell will be logical. And if they do view me, you know, they come and see my videos or they see my online content or whatever, they see me in person, they'll go, okay, it's clearly, it's satire. like I can make sense of this.
Yeah. Well, that's actually what I was going to sort of lead into. Because what I was going to say is when you're a dark comedian or you're dealing with dark comedy, you have to put up with a lot of criticism, and you know that you're going to get a bit, sometimes a very negative response from what you say. So down the line, eventually you have to deal with it. So that's the question I was trying to get into. Like, how do you deal with, you know, those types of those feedback, you know, where the woman's hitting you up and saying, you know, I found that offensive, or someone's coming up to you after your show? Like, how do you deal with that kind of feedback?
Okay. So, you can say anything you want on stage. You can, there is no thing that you cannot say. It's a free country. We're not in communist China, right? You say anything. You just have to be willing to deal with the repercussions of saying it, right? So, in order to do that, if you're going to do dark material, you better be a real stable person so that when people attack you, my answer to everything is, okay, you know. I mean, even to the point if they're like, I want you to apologize, I'll go, okay, I'm sorry. I mean, it's not like it changes anything, but they want to hear it. I've got no ego. I'm like, sure, I'm sorry. You know, I'll act sincere. So they feel like they've gotten that apology, so their life is better. And then I go out the next time and I do the same fucking joke. Right? One of the jokes that I got in so much trouble for. So how do you deal with this? I do a joke where the punchline is, what is the punchline? It's, oh, sorry. We're talking to this woman in the mall who's not a good looking woman. I said, sorry, I just thought you were this tranny guy that I know. Now, that joke, like, audiences laugh their tits off at that joke every time. But the LGBTQ+7 community got wind of it. And like most of my videos online will get 60 views in the first 2 weeks, right? This one got 1,000 views in the first 36 hours. And when you look at the playtime that people were watching for, they're coming for 2 seconds just to click dislike. Nobody watched it, okay? But they were enraged. They were enraged. Nobody come to complain. And I just went, like, okay, I just left it up there. And then at the time, I didn't know how to use that publicity, so I took the video down, and I had to do interviews with Out in Perth where they tried to destroy me and everything, but I was smart enough. So this is kind of an answer to the question. I was smart enough to get a lawyer because I knew right away what they're trying to do. You know, they're trying to defame me. So I was like, I have to really have a well-constructed argument that avoids whether or not, because they're asking me questions like, you know, why do you consider the word tranny funny? And I said, okay, first of all, your question implies my guilt that I do consider it funny. And I find it offensive that you are giving me leading questions that are presupposing my guilt. The question is, do I find it funny? And the answer is no. Next question. Right? So I destroyed them to the point where they didn't run the interview or the video or anything because it was too boring and too litigious, and they realized they didn't have anything and they were going to get themselves in trouble. So there's that approach. I mean, you could just not say it in the first place, but then why are you even doing comedy? Right? So you got to be able to deal with these repercussions, and sometimes you're going to have to spend money on it. And you better be a stable enough person to be able to take these punches to the face. I don't know.
That's a very strong lesson really to learn in comedy. And I feel like in the short time that I do it, the ones who have, who are sometimes like the most focused are the ones that are really the most stable and ones that, because it takes a lot of discipline. I learned that really the hard way. Like, it's a lot of traveling. It's a lot of unpaid work. You know, it's a lot of, you know, just rocking up to random places and talking in front of complete strangers. And then when I started doing it, I started to really respect all the people around me because, you know, no one's No one's here because they have to be here. Everyone's here because they want to be here. And
yes, correct.
That was the biggest one of the biggest lessons I learned. And it's just that when it comes to perfecting any craft, you've got to stay disciplined. So yeah. that's down the line. So that's the next question I wanted to lead on to you. Is like, how do you stay disciplined when it comes to writing jokes to going to gigs?
Yeah. Okay. So firstly, I'd like to touch on the point that since I've been doing comedy, I now respect the craft a lot more because now I understand, like you're saying, how crazy, how much work it is. You're doing like at least, they'll usually say 7 years, but my experience was a four-year apprenticeship, a four-year education, rather, learning how to write and all this kind of stuff. Then you start to get into an apprenticeship for a few years. And if you're good and disciplined, you'll start to make money after like 7 years. Like even from our Regal Theater show, when you look at everything, we didn't make that much money out of it. Not enough that you could be like, hey, that's me done for the year. It's a ton of work for a lot of growth, but very little financial gain. And even if you reach like that almost top tier, you're still just like hanging out at pubs and you're one of the best and you're making $500 to do a half hour three times a week. But I mean, that's after everything, $65,000 a year or something, right? $75,000 a year. It's not, and you're talking top comedians, not Dave Chappelle, but that next level down. And they're still struggling to pay their bills after being in it for 15 or 20 years. It's insanity. So how do I stay focused? Was that the question?
Yes.
Okay. Number one, I am just a very goal-oriented person. I don't really actually like goal setting. I like projects where I do a project for 6 months at a time. And I just devote myself 25 minutes a day, every single day for 6 months. Now, that requires a certain level of perseverance. Where do you get perseverance? Well, that probably has to do with upbringing type of stuff, right? But when it comes to comedy, and I heard a proper top comedian say this, if it is, it's so difficult and it's so time consuming and it's just so painful that if it is not a calling, if you don't feel like everything in the universe vibrates with your soul telling you to be a comedian, you can't last because the level of perseverance that is required and the amount of time over the years that is required, it is not possible to have that level of perseverance at something you hate, not even at something you love. It has to be something that it feels like the universe is calling you, that you are all consumed with. Because if it is not that, you'll have a bit of fun. You'll get into the community. It'll be a good little hobby, but you'll never turn it into a profession because it's just too painful to last that long. Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. And that leads to this next point that I wanted to ask you. You talk about that calling from the universe. You talk about that. It's got to be, you know, you got to put your heart and soul into it. It's got to be the thing that you do. Was there a point down the line where you felt like, okay, this is it. This is my calling. What was it?
Yeah, probably. But actually, still, I am convinced, okay? I am convinced that I'm supposed to be a public speaker talking about philosophy, almost like a motivational speaker, though I would never call it that because I don't give a shit if people are motivated by the facts. But, you know, almost along the line of a Ben Shapiro type of thing. Maybe not that conservative. But anyway, like that's what I want to be doing, okay? But what I'm supposed to be doing is this comedy thing. And I think that was straight from the get-go when I got this overwhelming feeling of I got to do comedy. And even though I was like, no, I'm not interested, I was convinced that it was what I'm supposed to do. And that has never changed. But now here's the trick with that. It doesn't matter if you actually get some calling from the universe or Jesus reaches out of the heavens and he's like, fuck, this is what you're going to do. So that doesn't matter. What creates the outcome is your belief in it, right? So I have just gone, you know what, screw it. I'm going to convince myself, whether or not this is what I'm supposed to do, I'm going to convince myself that it is what I'm supposed to do. I mean, there's like, within that philosophy, it's almost contradictory on itself, but I've just gone, screw it. This is what I'm going to devote myself to. And I'm just going to see how far I can push it. And it comes back down to that thing where it has to do with fear versus regret. And my fear of failure is minimal compared to my fear of regret. Because 100 years from now, if I fail miserably, I lose my family, got into comedy, and everything went awry. 100 years from now, nobody's going to remember. Nobody's going to care. I'm not going to remember because I'm going to be dead. However, on my deathbed, if I have to look at myself and go, you didn't do what you were supposed to do, then my life will lose all purpose because I will lose all respect for myself on my deathbed. And I'll go, you didn't do it. You didn't do, you're worthless, right? So I want to have a life worth remembering. Not for anybody else to remember, but, you know, for me to look back on my life and go, I did what I was supposed to do. So my fear of regret outweighs my fear of failure.
Wow. Good, good.
I don't know if I answered the question again, but I'm trying.
Damn close. If you did, it was damn close enough. That's all I could say. Now, the next part I wanted to talk about is a little bit about more about material. Now, when it comes to writing material, it can be a bit of a process. And to find the right material, it is almost like a bit of a marathon, really, how I'd say it. So when I first started, when I actually first met you, you sent me that document to help me write, and I started writing. And then one thing I tried to do was try and make it a habit. I said, okay, if I can write down 3 jokes per day. They don't even have to be good or bad, 3 jokes. And eventually 3 leads to 4 leads to 5 leads to 6, and then so on. And then you go on stage and then you promote it. So it's a bit of a process.
Then you go on stage and you bomb.
Yes, yes.
But you bomb yourself into success.
Yes.
You're bombing, and you figure out which ones work and which ones don't work.
Correct. And bombing is, without a doubt, like the one thing I like about it is that it's failure in its just most purest form. Like, you know, if you make a mistake in something else, sometimes you can just get away with it. But when you make a mistake on stage, they know and they remember. And yeah, that's one of the things I like about that. And it cuts deep. And I it. And I like it because one thing people say to me, oh, how do you do the things you do? I said, look, you don't understand what it's different to doing comedy. If I made a mistake, like in the gym or in the mat, that's fine. I'll learn and we'll forget about it. Yeah. But like, if I can make a mistake in front of so many people and they mock me for it, then there shouldn't be anything that you fear. So that was the biggest lesson.
It's instant feedback. That they hate you. They hate everything you're saying, which has come from your heart. So they hate your heart. They hate your material. They hate you as a person. It's the best shit ever.
Yeah. So,
look, when you're one-on-one with somebody and you say something wrong, like you drop the N-bomb or something, and people go, what is wrong with you? Like you might have a chance to explain it away. When you fuck up in front of an audience of 70 people, you're just, all you can say, if initially all you can say is, and then forget the rest of your material and walk off stage with your head down. And if you're good, like you're seasoned and you say the wrong thing, all that you've got, the only comeback you've got is, okay, moving on. That's it. Yeah, what was your initial question again? You said about material. Oh, so yeah. When it comes to the way that I did things, and this is what I wrote to you, and I got that partially from somebody else, and that is you just write down 50 things about yourself that aren't even funny, and then you just read them every day and you'll start to get little things of, oh, this would maybe be funny if I told this story or if I said this. And then after a couple of weeks, you have maybe 10 little two-line things that you can talk about. Like one of the things that I said, like one of the things I wrote down when I wrote down my initial list of 50 things was, I'm actually, you know, I'm comfortable with same-sex marriage. And what the joke became was, I'm all for same-sex marriage because any marriage with sex in it is better than my marriage. Now, that's not a joke that I really do anymore because I don't want to talk about my misses on stage, especially when it's not true, because that's only going to lead to trouble in my relationship, right? Uh-huh. But well, you do it. You have this one little premise, the one little starting sentence, and then eventually you think of a little twist that's funny. So you have all these little two-line jokes, the premise and the punchline, the premise and the punchline. And then what happens is you get on stage and you say it, and some of them do not work well, and some of them work great. And then, like, you, so the ones that work great, it's like throwing spaghetti against the wall to just see what sticks, you know? And at first, you take it really personal when people hate your jokes because you're like, they hate me and I'm a bad person. But at some point, you are able to make this distinction between my material that I'm testing and who I am as a person. So when I tell a great joke, it doesn't mean I'm a good person. And that's where people get confused. You get a lot of these comedians that move out of the amateur scene and they're like, I'm hilarious. Yeah, but you're 34 and you still live at home with your parents. You've never had a real job. I can't respect you. I'm sorry. Right? So stop strutting around like you got this huge ego. But then you'll tell a joke where it is terrible and you have to be willing to realize, okay, I'm not a terrible person. That there's a total difference. So then you can just get up on stage and I'll have a little piece of paper with two words that reminds me of the joke. And I look at it and I tell the joke and I see what the reaction is. And then if it's good, tick, you know, and if it's not, cross it out and go, okay, next joke, and then flip it. That's when you're at the open mic just testing material. Then eventually you accumulate a lot of this stuff and you say it over and over again. And then you start to ad lib and you add little things out of that joke. And instead of a 12-second joke, it now becomes 3 minutes, you know, because you're just adding on to it over the years. I'm out of things to say about that. I can't remember what the initial question was.
That's okay. Well, the next thing I wanted to bring up is about bombing. Now, I don't want to say his name, but I remember there was this one guy who I met once at the club, and he was very on and off. Sometimes I'd see him, I'd get up there and he would absolutely kill it. Some nights he would go up there and he wouldn't do bad, but when he would do bad, he'd take it very personally. Now, to add on what you said about bombing, is he said they hate you. I said, look, mate, again, look, you just because you had a bad night doesn't mean you're a bad person. So
yeah, but they have their entire view of themselves invested in comedy because they don't have any other hobbies. They don't have another job. A lot of comedians, their entire life is focused on comedy because nothing else is working for them. So then when it doesn't go well, they get to the point where they want to go home and cut themselves. It's crazy, dude. So, yeah, I don't know. It makes it difficult because you kind of go, look, like with a lot of these people, this is the environment I tried to create, is a situation where we go, look, you got to understand. We're gonna coach you to understanding that this is not everything. You'll grow and grow and grow and don't take it personally. But yeah, a lot of them take it real personally and it makes them lose their mind.
Yeah. Well, the question I was trying to lead into about bombing is like, what is the best way for a comedian to deal with bombing? Now, personally, myself, when it comes to bombing, I always tell myself the last thing I'm going to let it do is let it completely change my character. If something is bad to happen, I got to make sure that it's manifested in a positive way. So let's say, I'll tell you a personal story. I did a gig. It was in front of a lot of people, had a lot of friends there, had a lot of comedians there. And I just got absolutely embarrassed on stage and it was dreadful. and I look back at it and I laugh, but it was not because of the bombing on stage in front of all my friends and family and all those comedians. It was because what happened afterwards, I went home and then I sat down and then I listened to the tape because, and first of all, I hate listening to myself. I listen to it.
You gotta give it like 3 days before you listen to it because it's so emotionally traumatic. Yeah.
I said to myself, I gotta do this now. And then I think it was like 10 o'clock at night and I just sat down on my stool and I said, I'll go to bed when I can write at least 10 new points of material. And now I stayed up to like 1:30 a.m. and then I went to bed. Yeah, so that's my personal way of dealing with bombing. I just tell myself, look, you gotta put it into something positive. Like, get that anger, get that emotion out of you, put it into something positive.
That's probably the best way I've heard of dealing with it. Yeah. I just go curl up in the shower and at the bottom of the shower and just cry.
oh my God.
When you're first starting, like I remember those first, I remember it was 17 gigs because I kept track of all my gigs up to about 400. And because I wanted to make sure that I was on track to do two a week. And I averaged 2.02 a week for 4 years. At first it's really emotionally traumatic. And what tells you whether or not you're going to last at comedy is those first 20 gigs. If you can build up just a scar tissue on your jaw from just taking those punches. But I don't know, how do you deal with it? Yeah. At some point, hopefully somebody has just said to you, you need to distance yourself emotionally from the bombing. It is not you, you know, because the natural tendency is to go, oh, it's me. There's something wrong with me as a person or my sense of humor, but it has nothing to do with that. It just is a steep learning curve because you can be the funniest prick on the planet, but learning how to be funny in front of people you've never met who are judging you based on what they see in the first 10 seconds, not knowing who you are as a person, that's what you're trying to work around. And that just takes time to figure out. So, I mean, I don't know. How do you deal with a bomb? It's almost like some people can just deal with it and some people can't. But then also you see, and this is why a lot of people don't get up and do stand-up comedy in the first place, because apparently, my understanding is that the fear of public speaking is more intense for people than the fear of death. So anybody who actually gets up on that stage already just has balls of steel to be able to do it. And they must not, like, they must either be up for self-torture or something. I don't know. I don't know how you deal with a bomb. It's kind of like, how do you deal with a hangover? You get up the next morning, hair of the dog, you have a couple more drinks in the morning. That's how you get over a hangover, right? So with bomb, you just need to go out there and do that next gig and just take the next, because if you bombed really, really hard, the next one can't possibly be as bad. So as long as you don't have four where they get worse and worse and worse, even if it's getting worse, that one that turns up just a little bit, you feel like it's the best gig you've ever had because you're like suddenly, oh, I'm moving in the right direction. So I think the way you deal with a bomb is you do another 15 gigs.
Yeah, yeah. So why the number 16? Is there a significance behind it, or do you just feel like that's your personal experience?
No, it's just because that was my experience. And in my first one, it was great. 2 through 17 were terrible. And then the next one, everything started to move in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Fair enough. So you've been on the road. You've been doing the road now, and with the boys. And I want to talk about the road. Like, what was your favorite thing about being on the road?
So we haven't done a real road tour. Now, a real road tour is you pack up here in Perth and you just start driving for 6 months. You know, you're just doing the next pub and the next pub, and you've got them all set up along the way. And you're just, whether it be you setting it up or an agent or something, and you're just doing this tour for like 6 months. That's being on the road. What we do is we're here in Perth. We go up to this place 4 hours away, out to that place, down to here. You know, wait, that's all this side. Right. So ours is kind of like we got a central base, but on the weekends we go away you know, 3 hours and go do the gigs in various places. Or sometimes we'll do local ones. But really, it's just about running our own kind of semi-local tour where we're not going more than about 4 hours away.
Okay.
But okay. That, I mean, to be with you, it gives you an idea. Man, it is great. I mean, some of them, we would get there and they wouldn't have booked it from. They didn't sell the tickets like they were supposed to. And you've only got 15 people there. But that also is a real chance, because when you've got a huge audience, you can just do your rote material. You can just do this joke, then I know this one, then I know this one. And it'll just pick up pace. When you don't have at least 30 people in the audience, you need to talk to them like you're at a party and there's, you know, 10 of your cousins standing around. And you're talking, oh, yeah, Jim, and that happened to you, and Mike, oh, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, Tammy. So tell me about, like, how the kids are going. And then you ask leading questions where you say, okay, so, you know, as a woman, you ever play any sport? Yeah, okay, yeah. And if you have run into one of the situations where there's a man who identifies as a woman playing sport, oh, how's that make you feel? And then you go into your talk about your experience with that in a sport or what you've seen on television or whatever. And then you can do your joke that you wanted to do, because you're first kind of working the crowd and asking them the questions that lead to it. But anyway, the thing was, like, for our little tours, what we would say is, look, we're not out to make a whole bunch of money. Here's our fee. And you got to provide accommodation. And then it's cool, man. Like, you're there and you're in the hotel and, like, they think you're a rock star. They have no idea that you're, you know, when you look at the overall scheme, you're not a great comedian. You're pretty goddamn good, but you're not a Dave Chappelle. They haven't had anybody come to town. You know, it's a town of 1,500 people, 4 hours into the wheat belt. They're just ecstatic to get out on a Saturday night. And then you go well and you connect with them. And it was a fun night for everybody. And they got their money's worth. And they just want to drink with you. You know, like, come drink. And then you just, you know, you party with a few of the people left over in the audience till 2 a.m. And you drag yourself back to your bed. And you pass out, you wake up in the middle of the night because you pissed the bed, and then yourself up 8 a.m, you're waking up, having breakfast with the lads, chatting about all the shit that happened, and then it's the drive home. It is awesome. It's so much better than open mic comedy is a necessity. You need to suffer through it. You need to build your material. Even now, I still have to do open mics because I want to keep evolving my material. It's not like I have 10 hours to work from. And even if you have 10 hours of material, if you're not growing as a comedian, it's not going to be fun anymore. It's not going to bring you happiness. You need to keep growing. You need to keep building yourself. So you got to do the open mics. But man, going out and doing these different gigs where they're there, the people are there to see you, oh, it's so good. And I can see how comedians who are better than me do that kind of thing, and then their ego just gets like this. And they're like, I only want red M&Ms, and I expect that when I arrive at the hotel, there will be 2 prostitutes, or I will walk off the fucking show. They get to that. Because it is a real ego boost. And you just have to be able to look at yourself in the mirror and go, nope, you're still a piece of shit. Like, you're just, you know, it's just that you're doing well in comedy. Don't let it go to your head.
Awesome, man. So
the road is fucking.
Yeah.
Can you see those flies in the camera?
I saw a little one, but I didn't think I was saying it. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Anyway, so the next couple of there's a couple of points left I want to finish up on. Now you said you were on the road for 6 months. You did the road 6 months. Now 6 months. I'm sure you did a hell of a lot of gigs. But could you share with the audience, like, what was maybe one of the biggest lessons you learned on the road? He's thinking, ladies and gentlemen. He's thinking.
I don't know how I'm going to do more. And you set up a system where I could do more and more, and like the other ones, do less and less, because the next one's about this. And, you know, what Tim said, do And that built, you know, for 60 minutes. So one of the things I learned was that. Another thing that I did learn about Small Town WA, and I can't believe it, but I saw some other communities screw this up. You go to a small town that's rednecks in the Blue Belt, you know, it's very Bogan, it's very farm oriented. They're not progressive. You know, there's a lot of people that said something about, you know, gay marriage and went all around here, and you guys probably wouldn't be for that. But actually, they really would. You know? So, the people start to assume that your audience is a certain way. Right? Sometimes it's going big, like you can hear where it was on a Tuesday night, there were 75 people in the audience, and they were all over 50. Like, there was a lot of people who were 75 years old. Even the Tuesday night, you have nothing else to do, you know? And some of the people were like, oh, they're not going to like someone doing this video. I just find it good.
Well done. Interesting. I felt that's actually a really good way to put it. It was well done for sharing that. Now, we're just coming to the end of this. Now, I just wanted to ask you real quick, man. You've been doing this for some time. I'm looking forward to catching you around at the next gig. Some of my audience will be looking to want to come down as well. Where can they find you? Like, what open mics spots do you normally perform at, or would you like to promote? Or is there any shows that you got coming up?
Look, I got a show coming up tonight.
Okay.
I don't know if this will be broadcast. Is this broadcast live right now?
No, but it's literally going to go up today, so people will be listening to it today.
At Bright Tank in Perth, I will be the MC tonight for it. It'll be quite a stellar lineup, actually. That's not really an open mic. That'll be a good one. That's tonight. And then our shows, we're starting to book. If you want to see where they're all going to be, you go to on Facebook, The Flannel Panel. Other guys always wear the flannel panel. You go there and you'll see where any of our gigs are. And then the other thing, man, just I'm about to release my video of my full Regal Theater show tonight. So
awesome.
I'll send, as soon as I get it, I'll send you the link and then you can attach it. It'll be, I got to spend another couple of hours editing some of the audio and a couple of video transitions. And then it'll be ready. I'll upload it and I'll send you the link. And I can already have the link for my my little doco, put that on there, and they can start to get an idea of what I actually do and what my character is like. Because on stage, I am not who I am here. This is the person I am. Who I am on stage is, as Tim pointed out, the person I want to be, right? I was raised kind of small town, then we moved to the big city. And I want to move to Tasmania pretty soon. I've got a house over there. I want to be a redneck. So everything I do on stage is about redneck stuff and about interpretation of my family and how they're redneck and the kind of shit they would say. So I reckon that's the place to start is watch the doco and watch the full length special. And then this year, anytime you come see me, I'll mostly be doing the MC work, connecting with the audience. And we'll be having Tim Kershaw doing most of our headlining this year.
Awesome. Now, before I let you go, man, is there anyone you want to thank?
You. I don't know, man. You know, look, especially, I would say Tim Kershaw. The one who has really inspired me to go to the next level during the last year.
Awesome. Yeah, I agree. Shout out to Tim. Well done, man. All right, Jimmy, I will say thanks again. It was an honor having you on, buddy. I'll catch you again. The show's real soon. And I'm looking forward to seeing you on stage, man. Really, really appreciate it. All the best, buddy.
Joe, hey, come down next Thursday. Come to the Billabong Brewing Company, because that's where I will be, regular open mics, every Thursday or every other Thursday. I'll be down there. I'll be doing a lot of the MCing down there. So come down there, Joe, and I'll see you at those gigs.
Awesome, man. Appreciate it, buddy. Thank you very much.